The recording has started. You may now begin.
Great. Thanks, JR. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the GNSO Bylaws Implementation Drafting Team call on the 15th of September at 1900 UTC. On the call today, we do have Farzeen Bani, Darcy Southwell, David Maher, Edward Morris, Steve Del Bianco, Steve Mattel, and we do have apologies from Amar Al-Sadr. From staff, we have Julie Hedlund and myself, Michelle DeSlider. As a reminder, I'd like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes.
Hey, thanks, everyone. It's Steve Del Bianco. First, apologies for having to move the call from our scheduled time yesterday. I was a witness in the hearing in the U.S. Congress Senate Judiciary Committee on the transition, and many apologies for that. Darcy, you have your hand up?
Sorry, that was an accident.
Oh, no problem. And one of the first things we do on here is to review the agenda, roll call, statements of interest. So let me just give one statement that I'm sure you're interested in, which is how that hearing went and how it could have implications for our group. I think the hearing revealed that there is significant opposition on Republican members of Congress to doing the transition this month, if at all. That's not new, but it was a little surprising about the breadth of that. How would that show up? The only way it's likely to show up is that the resolution funding the government, which would probably only run through early December, which would be October and November and 1 week of December, approximately 9 weeks, that may have a very firm prohibition on relinquishing the IANA contract. So that would last approximately 9 weeks, and that would force the hand of NTIA to tell ICANN, perhaps as soon as tomorrow, but more likely by the end of September, would tell ICANN, look, we're going to extend it. I understand the automated term of extension is a year, but it could be less than that. And since it's only a 9 week period, I'm not as concerned that a lot of mischief could happen. It's not as if the UN would begin pounding shoes on the podium. And I don't think, Ed Morris is mentioning something in the chat, which was too funny. But I don't think that we have to go to the board and ask them to honor their commitment of ripping those bylaws apart and implementing all of the accountability reforms like they committed to, and then taking out all of the IANA reforms, like the IANA Functions Review, Customer Standing Committee, Post-Transition IANA. More than likely, it's prudent to just leave all that alone for 9 weeks as we wait and see if the political climate in the U.S. cools down after the election. It could actually heat up. We don't really know. But if things cool down, we wouldn't have needed to reopen and relitigate the bylaws, which I think would be a disaster, and we won't have needed to stir up the UN too much if things get back on track after the election. So with that view in mind, I think that this group, this drafting team, still has to work as if our deadline is about 16 days from now, and that is our deadline to have an implementation report about which we have consensus and about which we would hand to the council on September 30th for their disposal, since we serve at the request of council pursuant to a resolution. So before we jump into the full-blown agenda here, I thought I would see if there are any comments or questions regarding how that hearing yesterday might affect our work. Go ahead, Ed Morris.
Thanks, Steve. I just want to agree with everything you've said. I've spoken to folks. I'm in Boston right now. I've spoken to people in Markey's office today, some friends down in D.C. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, but we shouldn't be reactive to things that may be changing on a daily basis in Washington. We should just keep doing the work as scheduled that we intended to do. And the worst-case scenario is we're just going to be ready. In worst case, we're going to be ready 11 months in advance. That's not a bad thing. So I agree with your proposal to just keep going on the schedule we've had just keep plowing away as if nothing's happening outside our little bubble.
Thank you, Ed. I will note that if the NTIA used its option to extend by 1 year, it could still terminate earlier if early December proved that Saner heads prevailed, or it could ask ICANN at any time to terminate earlier. So I think the 1 year might be just what's in the contract, but it doesn't have to be the full extent. And then Julie Hedlund notes, she's right, our deadline is part of a council motion. So obviously we still want to honor what the council motion asked us to do, and we'll take it from there. Any other comments? Ed, your hand is still up. Okay, great. I want to thank staff for the comprehensive notes they took after our last call. And reading the notes makes it seem like it was a pretty productive call, in the sense that we did a bit of a straw poll on whether GNSO itself could express its preferences, or would we continue to use counsel to express the will of the GNSO. It was only a straw poll. We have 9 members on this drafting team, and that straw poll indicated that currently we're going to proceed as if the council speaks for the GNSO. There was one document that staff, Julie in particular, did for us about 3 weeks ago, where she dove into the new bylaws to look for where the word council or GNSO council was used, and other places where the word GNSO was used without the word council after it. No need to bring that up right now in detail, but that's at our disposal. If we ever wanted to go back and understand whether there was any purposeful measures in the bylaws that tried to suggest that it goes to the GNSO, my read of Julie's analysis is that there are several instances where the word GNSO supermajority showed up in a paragraph speaking about council, CCNSO Council, and it strikes me that it was probably inadvertent that it really meant a GNSO Council supermajority, since there was no such thing as a GNSO supermajority unless we were able to design one in this group. So while we're recapping, before we dive into today's agenda, Steve Metallis, your hand's up. Go right ahead.
Yes, thank you. This is Steve Metallis. Just really just 2 points. First, on what you just mentioned, in fact, in the current bylaws, there is a definition of GNSO supermajority, and it means two-thirds of the council members of each house or three-fourths of the council members of one house and a majority of the council members of the other house. So whether or not GNSO supermajority was used inadvertently there or not, it is now currently a defined term in the bylaws. So I just wanted to correct that. And I also just want to make sure that no misunderstanding about last week's meeting and what came out of that. I on behalf of my constituency, we do not agree with the proposal that the GNSO Council should speak for the GNSO on these non-PDP matters that we've identified that arise out of the new bylaws. But I recognize that that's a minority viewpoint in this group at currently, but I do want to make the record clear on that. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Steve. You're absolutely correct on the point of using GNSO instead of council, and I think the notes faithfully reflect that. And we have to achieve consensus in this drafting team, so I thought that it was prudent to move ahead, given that there was only a minority in favor of bypassing council. So that's one of the reasons we're trying to move ahead on that. And Steve, you're also exactly correct. The word GNSO supermajority is a defined term that implies council, and in the 4 places where it's used in the new bylaws, the word GNSO supermajority are both capitalized. So if, in fact, that meant that they were selecting, the drafters were selecting the word supermajority to be council, that would say that there isn't really any ambiguity in the new bylaws, and that every instance GNSO is referenced, it's either explicitly indicating council or implicitly indicating council. because the term supermajority means council. Steve, I'll just pause there. Would you agree that the new bylaws seem to be unambiguous about council and not GNSO?
On those, in those areas, yeah. This is Steve Metallitz again. So in 18.2, at 18.12, let's see, where else is it said? 19.1, 19.4, I think those are the places where the new bylaws, if I'm not mistaken, those are the places where the new bylaws refer to GNSO supermajority. And I think that it is capitalized, so I think it does mean to reference that definition.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve. And thank you, Julian, and to the extent Michelle and other staff members helped with that analysis. That was a quick turnaround, and that helped us to stay on this track. So with all respect to the minority view that we don't necessarily have to pick council, we can make it be GNSO. With all respect for that for now, given we have just 2 weeks for our deadline, I propose that we proceed like we did on the last call, which was to assume the council speaks for GNSO, and this is on the agenda there today. And then we had said, now we move to the question of what is going to be the voting threshold for at least three types of decisions. And we have three types of decisions laid out, and if we can come up with thresholds for those three, it is easy to map those onto the table indicating all of the different decisions that the new bylaws put in front of GNSO. And those three types of decisions are the approval of nominations to entities like post-transition, IANA, the customer standing committee, review teams required under the bylaws, not just the affirmation anymore, and an empowered community representative. Those are nominations that will be required for the GNSO where they were not before. The second was to approve decisions and actions that are available in the bylaws to the empowered community, and that would be considering it as a petition from another member of the empowered community to, for instance, block an ICANN budget or launch a community-based IRP. And then the third, Ed Morris brought up, which is the notion of exercising the new document inspection and investigation rights. And Ed, you brought that up as a third category. I would have thought that was part of the second category of a decision, a yes-no decision. That is, do we launch an inspection investigation? And yet, I think you make a good case that simply requesting document inspection and investigation should not have to achieve a very, very high threshold, since it's not definitive, it's not determinative. It simply asks for more information. So it might well deserve a lower threshold than approving an action of the empowered community. And then on last week's discussion, we talked about the different kinds of thresholds that could work. We all acknowledge that the default threshold in ICANN bylaws, and called the word default, is that a majority of each house, and included in there is the nominating committee representatives to each house, the voting NCA reps. So they're part of what's called the default rule. And as Ed Maher and others have pointed out, David Maher pointed out, we in council has used that default rule for non-policy related decisions, like appointments to review teams, like whether or not to approve a charter for something like the CWG and the CCWG. Those were all done on the majority of each house. And no matter what we do here, that majority of each house rule will still be in the bylaws. We are investigating whether we want to recommend a different set of voting thresholds that don't necessarily divide the world by house. Since Nick Steve Metallitz made this point on our last call, the house structure was a last-minute compromise coming out of a GNSO restructuring of 6 years ago, and it was designed for policy decisions. That was what the house structure was designed for, and the default rule for non-policy matters was a majority of each house. And what I would propose is that we have a robust discussion of other kinds of voting thresholds for just the purposes of, let's say, approving nominations, empowered community, and document inspection rights. So please make it clear, this does not, even if we were to agree upon a simple majority of counselors for the purpose of a review team appointee, that does not restructure the council, and it doesn't change anything about the way the council votes today. All the council voting rules are still in place, but we would be writing or recommending a council voting rule for these three categories of matters that come before us because of the transition. So it's totally separate. So Steve Metallis, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to go back to the 3 points that are in this agenda about the kind of three categories of actions. And I'm a little confused about this, and I think maybe it's just a wording problem, but you refer to these as three types of empowered community actions. And the first one is approving nominations. I think when we first had this discussion, you said that those are the who questions, you know, who will represent the GNSO on various entities. Then number two is approving decisions and actions available to the empowered community. Those are the kind of the yes, no, or instructions. You know, do we support or not support some action that the empowered community is being asked to take? And then the third, you have document inspection and investigation rights. The concern I have is that, and maybe it's just because of the empowered community language, there's actually several other places where the GNSO is empowered to act as a decisional participant or in some other way under the new bylaws, some capability or action that it didn't have under the old bylaws. And I don't know whether those, and they're not necessarily empowered community activities, certainly not part of the EC, you know, whatever that is, the entity that exercises the powers of the empowered community. Inspections is one example of those, but there are others. And so I just wanted to expand this third category a bit, or else make it clear what the second category covers, because I think there are several things that the GNSO is empowered to do that aren't really empowered community activities. One has already been mentioned, which is inspection 22.7. Then there's also 22.8, which is determining whether there's a credible allegation that ICANN has committed fraud or gross mismanagement. And that's the decision that GNSO, along with two or more other decisional participants, can make. And it sets it leads to an independent investigation and so forth. But that's, again, it's not an empowered community. It's not the empowered community acting. It's some decisional participants. So that's another example. I've got two or three more, but all I'm saying is that there are some things that I don't think are empowered community roles, but that are new roles for the GNSO.
Hey, Steve, would you take a question for a moment, please?
Yes, please.
Thank you. The word decisional participant is capital D, capital P. And so I thought it was very clear that the word decisional participant is the GNSO's appointed representative to the empowered community. That is the only thing that a decisional participant could be. So everywhere there appears decisional participant, I believe that's the empowered community. There may still be other instances where it doesn't say the decisional participant, it just says ACs and SOs. So you're right on. We may have other of those to deal with, and I get that. But isn't decisional participant explicitly the GNSO representative to the EC?
Okay, so if that's the case, I'm sorry, this is Steve again. If that's the case, then you're saying that 22.8, which is
mm-hmm.
making a joint written certification from the respective chairs of each such decisional participant, that the constituents of such decisional participants have, pursuant to the internal procedures of such decisional participants, determine there's a credible allegation, et cetera, et cetera. So GNSO is going to sign on to a certification along with two other entities that are decisional participants. That has to, that comes from the chair of the decisional part, from the, of the GNSO. But it's the constituents have determined that there's a credible allegation. So you that decision, you would put that in the second category as a yes-no decision that the GNSO has to make as a decision action available to the empowered community. I'm just...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, only because I see the word decisional participant, and that is an artifact of only one entity called the empowered community.
Okay. All right. I think you're right about that. So that could, that would go in the the second category.
I think you bring up a great point on the first category, and we'll get to you in just a second, Ed. On the first category of nominations, I was attempting to say that that first category of nominations were only those nominations that we make as resulting from the new bylaws, knowing that there may be other kinds of nominations that GNSO and council make from time to time.
Right.
Ed Morris?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I actually agree with Steve Metalis in that when we drafted this, 22.7 and 22.8, I was intentionally involved in actually putting the language together, at least making proposals. We specifically designed both these powers technically to be outside of the empowered community. So let me just take both of them briefly. On 22.7, for those who really don't know what's going on here, a few folks that weren't really involved in the CCWG are on the call. This is a limited inspection right. It's not the DIVP. It's only for information related to the GNSO's role as a part of the empowered community. But where it differs from some of the other decisions is we institute actions for documents through this separate right. You know, the chair has to make the request for documents. We do not have to talk to any other decisional participant. It's directly from us to ICANN itself. So that differentiates it a little bit from the other aspects of the empowered community. And why it's, what it's specifically put in a different section of the bylaws and is not part of the general empowered community rights. 22.8 is a mixed bag because although we do have to act in concert with other SOACs, other decisional participants, we can institute this thing ourselves initially through ICANN. We do not, we have to go and talk to others, but there's going to be, as I understand it, and I looked at the bylaws and it doesn't say exactly what I understood it was supposed to be, but it doesn't rule it out either, and that we could institute the action. There's going to be a lead decisional participant. And we can institute the action in conjunction and sign off with others, but the 22A power, we need to, on the GNSO level, make sure we have a way of starting the request for the independent investigation. In other words, what separates these two from the others is these require instituting action at the council level, if we're going to go that route, or at the GNSO level. We have to determine who actually can request this to be begun, and in the case of 22.7, it really is not part of the community empowerment structure because we do can do this independently of every other part of ICANN and every other part of the independent of the community empowered community. Thanks.
Ed, when you on the last call added the third category of documents inspection and investigation rights, were you specifically referring to 22.7A and 22.8?
22.7 more than 22.8. 22.8 is sort of a mixed bag in terms of where we should place it. 22.7 clearly is a different kettle of fish because it's a direct request from us, from the GNSO, to ICANN without any relationship to any other member of the empowered community. It exists outside the empowered community.
Okay. The bylaws themselves in Section 6.1, the new bylaws, define it this way. They say the empowered community is a nonprofit association formed under the state of California, ASO, CCNSO, GNSO, and ALAC, and the GAC. Each is a decisional participant, in quotes, and collectively they're known as the decisional participants. So as you say in the chat, I believe it was you, Matt, that the decisional participants are the SOs and the ACs, and where does this leave us? If in fact it's the distinction that, it, that the word decisional participant in many cases is exercising a power that's given to the empowered community, because the empowered community is the only place that the word decisional participant is created. I realize that it doesn't necessarily have to be the designated representative to the empowered community, but it's clear that decisional participant is a word that only exists in the context of the new empowered community. So I'm trying to understand, if you're agreeing with Steve Metallis, what are the implications of suggesting that the decisional participant is somehow different than our representative to the empowered community, who is supposed to provide whatever council told them to say, vote yes on this decision or vote no, and they pass that decision through to the empowered community. That's a representative to the empowered community. We have to actually designate an individual to be that person. That's a nomination. And then from time to time, we'll have to give that person instructions on what to say. And that is, those instructional resolutions in council would be the kinds of resolutions that are up for a yes-no vote for the purpose of giving instructions on participation. That kind of a construct would work for instructing them what to say about an investigation in 22-8 or a request to inspect the accounting books and records, which is 22-7. So it might be a distinction without a difference. But please educate me if there's something more to that. Steve Metallis?
Yeah, this is Steve Metallis. One difference is, as you said, in the in most of the empowered community activities, the GNSO acts through its designated representative to the decisional participants. But on 22-8, it has to act through its chair. And it has to act based on what the constituents have decided using their own internal procedures. So that is one difference. Our designated representative might not be the chair.
And you're right. It might not be the chair, but if the chair – so the representative would not be able to communicate a decision on 22-8. It would have to be the chair of GNSO Council. I think that's your point.
Yeah, it would have to be the chair of the GNSO. But
we only have a GNSO council, though, at this point.
I think the question remains, and I don't want to split hairs about this, that's another type of decision that GNSO has to make. You know, do we think there's been a credible allegation of fraud, et cetera? I will say that is not, doesn't have anything to do with policy, necessarily have anything to do with the policy development process, probably wouldn't in most cases. It actually tracks quite closely, or more closely, some of the kinds of roles that the leadership of the constituencies and of the stakeholder groups have to play. Because they're the ones that have to manage the budgets of their constituencies or stakeholder groups. And so they're the ones with a management function. The councilors have no management function. They just manage the PDP process. They don't manage an organization, which the leadership does. So this is a good example, in my view, of the kind of decision that doesn't fit well with the GNSO Council exercising this. But my point here is that it is another type of decision, and I think I would tend to agree with you that we could put that under the second bullet, but it's not the same kind of decision. And as Ed has pointed out, the inspection one, It only involves the empowered. I'm not sure how it involves the empowered community, because it's really an empowered SO. An SO is empowered to set this thing in motion to ask for documents.
Thank you, Steve. So I'll note that the word decisional participant, while an artifact only of the empowered community, could mean either of two things. There are some places where it means the representative to the empowered community. And there are other instances like 22-8 where the chair of the SO is the one who speaks for the decisional participant, because the bylaws wrote it that way. In both cases, we need to come up with a rule for how the GNSO instructs that individual, whether it's the chair or the representative to the EC. Either way, we need voting thresholds for how to instruct them. And I think the other takeaway is that we don't necessarily have to have as high a threshold to launch an investigation as we do for taking an action like blocking a budget or spilling the board. There are some particular empowered community powers that might deserve a higher threshold. And we could go right to that and start mapping it out, but we still have to start to sort agreement out about exploring voting thresholds that deviate from majority of each house. And we haven't done a straw poll on that yet today. We discussed it briefly on our last call, and I actually prepared a table that I was hoping to display at some point in this call so we could get into what it would mean to move away from majority of each house only for the purposes of these kinds of decisions. But let me stay with the queue and go to Ed Morris and then David.
Thanks, Steve. Very briefly, you can add 22.7 to 22.8 in terms of the bylaw specifically stating it's the chair of the decisional participant. In other words, the chair, however we designate as the chair of the GNSO, that makes the inspection request to the secretary of ICANN itself. So it is outside, particularly 22.7 really is outside the empowered community, because although we're using the decisional participant classification to talk about the SO, the fact is it's completely outside any other part of the community, completely outside of relations with other SOACs. And I will note that in the bylaw itself, we've actually referenced Section 6333 of the California Corporate Code, which is the membership inspection rights, which when we were back in the membership mode, would have gone down to the SOAC level, which is what this is designed to do. Thanks.
But Ed, couldn't you clarify that the empowered community is the sole designator? It is the entity that's acquiring these powers under California law, and the bylaws seem to be clear that it's decisional participants that end up being the entities that participate in that. So it strikes me that the empowered community organization identifies who may, under California law, do one of these requests for document inspection. Is that right?
More or less. I mean, the deal is decisional participant is a definition outside of any particular function. So we can have the decisional participant working outside of the empowered community format or inside it. In other words, when we're dumping a board member, we're obviously working with inside the empowered community. But when we're making a document request under the inspection right, we're communicating directly with the Secretary of ICANN, and we have nothing to do with anyone else in the empowered community. So I would argue that this is a completely separate function. The only part of this, which is part of the empowered community, really isn't. It's the definition of who the decisional participant is, which, again, it's not part of the function of the empowered community. It's part of the definition within the bylaws of what that means. So it has nothing to do with the function. It's more of a definitional category, which in the case of the inspection rights particularly, as you can see, it really doesn't belong in the empowered community itself. I mean, this was something that was by design. It was designed to take these two rights outside of the empowered community so we could actually use Section 6333, which is a membership right. We ported the membership rights directly here, and the appeal functions for the inspection right, which I'm a little bit more familiar with, are the IRP. It's the step process, and we would be doing that outside of the community as well. If we were to have to appeal a decision of ICANN, we would not be involving the empowered community in making the appeal or going through the step processes.
Can I ask you a clarification question? There are ACs and SOs, at least ACs, that are not part of the empowered community by their own decision. Therefore, they do not have, they are not decisional participants, and they do not have the rights in 22.7 and 22.8. Would you agree?
Yes.
Yeah, so again, I have to say the decisional participant is an artifact of the empowered community. The powers that we're speaking of are reserved only to members of the empowered community, and they're called decisional participants. And so we need, within GNSO, a mechanism to instruct them to vote yes or no on whether to launch a document request under the powers that we have. The default rule in the bylaws today is a majority of each house, and that includes the NomCom reps for each to make that decision. And so we could continue to deep dive on the subtle distinctions between some of the powers, but if we are going to end up at the default rule, we will have wasted a lot of time doing that. So we have to test the waters here. We have 9 of us on this drafting team, and we need a consensus. We have to start to test the waters on something other than the default voting rule of a majority of each house. Since if we don't start to move towards a consensus on that, then everything just goes to the default rule. And we don't have to parse the differences between 22-8 and everything else in there. I'll stop there. Ed, your hand's still up. Did you want to go on a little bit? David Maher, go ahead.
Thank you. It's David Maher. In response to Steve Metellus, I've heard nothing yet that persuades me that departure from the default rule is supportable by this group. Thank you.
David, if I could, on the last call, after we moved to the scenario where counsel speaks for GNSO, we had a pretty robust discussion of what kinds of voting thresholds would be appropriate for something like a nomination to the PTI liaison. And I realized that you did say that your preference was a majority of each house. We'll call that the default rule. But then we discussed, and I actually suggested a majority of the participants on the last call were open to the idea of something like a majority of counselors if we addressed the weighting. So I'm not saying that we did a straw poll, we didn't do a vote, but the discussion revealed quite a lot of open-mindedness to moving away from the split house, majority of each house, for something like a nomination. Go ahead.
To David Maher, I can see some reason to discuss different voting levels, provided that it's the voting level by each house. But maintaining the principle of each house, to me, is of primary importance.
All right, David, let's make sure that the staff would reflect that David is saying that even if it was not a majority threshold in each house, that David's view is that it must still be voting rules applied to each house. And if I've got that captured in the notes, that's right. But I don't agree with your observation that there was no support to continue discussing other means of determining the majority of counsel. I think it was more open than that.
That's David Maher. I just said I've heard nothing.
Okay. I got it. Matthew Shears?
Yeah, Steve, can you hear me all right?
We do.
Perfect. Thanks. I guess that coming into the discussion, I apologize that I missed the last call. I guess coming into this discussion now, my feeling about this is that whether we call it the default rule or not, that I think is pretty clear that for everyone that tends to be the point of departure. We seem to be jumping right into the exceptions to the default rule, and I'm just wondering if we need to clarify and pursue what we believe the default rule is and where it applies first before we jump into the nitty-gritty of the exceptions. And I tend to agree with David. I think that in as much as it is possible, it's desirable to apply the default rule. I think that the less that we can change and bring exceptions to that, probably the better at this point in time. Thanks.
Matthew, on the last call, you may have missed this discussion, but staff helped us to walk through the bylaws of ICANN, and this part of it was not affected in any way by the transition bylaws. But in the bylaws, it defines specific types of policy decisions and the thresholds that are necessary, launching a PDP, approving a consensus policy, et cetera. There are a whole series of about 14 different voting rules associated with policy, There's three new ones associated with launching sort of a non-policy general issue. And then there's the default. So it falls at the very end of that list, such that default is a majority of each house, and it's meant to describe anything that's not covered in the list above. So in the list above, since it was written before we did the transition, there's nothing about empowered community nominations to the PTI. There's nothing about it. So if we didn't do anything, if our group just quit, the bylaws would use the default rule, and council would speak for GNSO and a majority of each house on any resolution regarding the empowered community, document inspection, and everything else. Since they're not described in the bylaws, they fall to the default. So our challenge is, if we want to create something other than the default, we can do so. It is within our charter to recommend to council, if we can get a consensus here, to recommend a different way that GNSO would vote on a nomination to PTI. Recommend a different way on how GNSO would launch an investigation under 22.7 or 22.8, or how GNSO would indicate its preference on whether to spill the board of directors. It is our option to insert that there. If we do not succeed at achieving consensus in that, the default rule is already baked into the bylaws, and that is what would happen. So, Matthew, with that long answer, does it make sense to you?
Steve, thanks. It absolutely makes sense to me, and that is more or less what I understood. I guess I'm just reinforcing that notion that is a desirable state of play from my
perspective. Okay. On the last call, we discussed ways where it may not be as desirable as you might imagine. And let me give you an example. I put up on the screen a silly little Excel sheet I did that explains the way council is split today into two houses, and each house gets a nominating committee representative, the NCA. Steve Metallis, myself, several others on the last call are wondering why a NOMCOM rep who has no constituency in GNSO would get any vote at all when GNSO was asked a question about spilling the board of directors. We acknowledge that the NOMCOM rep voting roles were specifically created to break ties on policy decisions inside of GNSO Council. And that's an artifact of six years ago. And I believe we had a pretty robust discussion about whether NOMCOM representatives would have any vote at all. And Ed Morris is the NOMCOM nominee for this particular drafting team. So no disrespect, Ed. This is about whether the NOMCOM rep has anything to do with representing the interests of the GNSO. So on the screen in front of you, and Matt, is your hand up to weigh in at this point? Not hearing anything. Just put your hand up if you want to get back in the queue. Anybody can. So all I did on the screen was I jumped into Excel and I laid out in the first column there is how it works today. How it works today is there's one vote for each of these counselors, and I put the two NOMCOM reps in there. So that's a total of 13 in the non-contract party house, a total of 7 in the contract party house, and that's 13 and 7, or 20. And under the default rule in the bylaws, called a majority of each house, right, you have to get 4 out of 7 in the contract party house to get a majority, and you have to get 7 out of 13 in the non-contract party house. And because there's a split between registries and registrars, the NOMCOM rep breaks a tie amongst registries and registrars. And I guess there have been times that the commercial stakeholder group and the non-commercial stakeholders group don't see eye to eye, and then the NOMCOM rep breaks that tie. That's happened less and less frequently lately. But it is a reality that a majority of each house rule puts the NOMCOM reps in an immensely powerful position, and they have zero accountability to the SOs and ACs in GNSO. I'm also a rapporteur on the SOAC accountability group in Workstream 2, and the streams haven't crossed yet. It's not as if we've merged these two, and I see Farzi in the queue. We haven't merged the two, but the fact that accountability to the underlying SOs and ACs is essential to us. It's part of our bylaws. I don't know how we would have NOMCOM reps vote on a decision completely unrelated to policy. And that is where I put the two yellow columns that you have on the screen in front of you. I said, if we were to move to a majority of counselors or two-thirds of counselors, you would have to do two things. You would eliminate the nominacom reps, and you would have to double the weight of the contract party house, since they only have six individuals against 12 individuals on the other side. I know the weighted voting was anathema to us, but we never really got rid of it. We never really got rid of it because we require a majority of each house, and the houses themselves are effectively the same thing as double voting. This is a chance to balance things, and that was the term David Maher used. You balance between contract and non-contract, but you don't require that each side of that balance always have a majority. Majorities can be found many other ways. And that is why I put those columns called test case A, B, C, D, and you can come up with infinite test cases where majorities and even two-thirds majorities can be knit together among counselors without requiring majority of each house. So time for me to shut up and go to the queue. Farzi.
Yes, hi, Steve. Thank you. So my question about the NOMCOM appointee would be that when you're saying that NOMCOM appointee is there to break tie, does that mean that the NOMCOM appointee actually brings more balance to the decision? If that is the case, then I would be concerned if we do not weigh the NOMCOM appointee's vote. Thank you.
Farzi, the balance is the idea of seeing that contract parties and non-contract parties have equal votes. That's what balance is meant there. And even if you were to make the argument that NOMCOM is a balance factor, you're one of the co-rapporteurs on SO and AC accountability, and we will not pass the SO and AC accountability test if we try to suggest that NOMCOM reps speak for the SO and AC. That would just be my observation. And Ed Morris?
Yeah, hi, Steve. I've reached out to a few people since last week trying to figure out, from my own mind, what the NCAs are supposed to do. And I'm not getting a consensus. I've talked to some folks on NOMCOM currently and in the past. Some actually agree with your position or your view that they're just there to break ties. Others agree with our current NOMCOM appointees, who I've spoken to two of the three in one of the incoming non-voting NOMCOMs, who believe they're there to vote on behalf of the entire GNSO, which I actually don't think, in terms of the bylaws, they're supposed to. But so there's a variety of views as to what the NOMCOM is there for. I still have not finalized my own view on the matter. I'm a bit confused. I can argue both arguments with equal conviction. But the one thing I will point out is that the vote on council to approve whatever recommendation we come up with here will include NOMCOM votes, and I know at least the two voting NOMCOM members will vote against it if we wipe them completely off the board. That's just a practical political consideration folks may want to consider.
Ed, Steve, I think that once our drafting team, once we have a consensus recommendation, when it goes to council, it falls into the default rule. So if council were to accept our recommendations, it would end up doing so in a majority of each house.
I believe we put a supermajority provision in there. Staff can probably back me up or correct me on that.
Yeah, I'm going to quickly check that on our original charter that came to us from council. And let's move on to David.
I just want to say, this is David Maher. I agree with Ed. I think that function of the non-com participants is an open question. But I do believe that many of them do take account of the views of their the group that they're connected with.
When you said you agree with Ed, Ed was indicating he's uncertain about their role. What is your particular point about NOMCOM?
Well, I agree that it's uncertain, but I take issue with what you've said about the non-coms being totally disconnected from the stakeholder groups. I don't think that's correct in the way the council has worked.
So your personal your experience is that they have been they have endeavored to represent the interests of the entire GNSO or just the house they happen to be assigned to?
They'd certainly take account of the views of the house they're assigned to. That's
and
my experience from the registry stakeholder group.
Okay. Okay. Let's make sure we note that. And thank you, Ed Morris. You were right. The council resolution, the last section, said that when council weighs our recommendations, that it requires a GNSO supermajority. And then Steve Metallitz.
Yes, thank you. Just on this NCA question, I'm sure, you know, based on my experience observing, not serving on the council, but observing the council and through a dozen or so NOMCOM appointees, sometimes what David says is true and sometimes it's not. And, you know, sometimes they take, they consult with the house where they're sitting and sometimes they don't. And either way, it's kind of irrelevant. That's not accountability. And we had many discussions a year or two ago about what constitutes accountability, and I seem to recall we had a whole cross-community working group on this question. And clearly one element of accountability is, if you will, the power to hire and fire. And nobody in the GNSO has the power to make somebody a NOMCOM appointee. No group in the GNSO has that power. No group in the GNSO has the power to recall or to divest them of that status. That's it's not saying that they're isolated or bad or out of touch. They're not accountable. And the only reason that we have them is because we have this practical problem of breaking a tie between very divided and balanced forces within a particular house. So I would agree with you, Steve Del Bianco, that there's a big accountability issue here if the NCAs have a role in making the kinds, some of the kinds of decisions, at least, that we've been talking about here. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Ed Morris?
Yeah, well Steve Metallitz. If the NCA is not accountable because it can't be recalled, I just get reelected to council. I can't be recalled for 2 years. There's nothing the NCSG can do to recall me for the next 2 years, and I'm not eligible for reelection. I'm termed out. So if the non-coms are unaccountable, I'm unaccountable. I don't think that non-coms are as accountable as I am to the people who appointed me. And they, I believe, at least according to the current NCSG appointee to NOMCOM, they're pretty much selected on the basis of someone to take a general view of the goodness or the interest of the entire GNSO. So my view, the NOMCOMs, if I'm accountable to the NCSG, despite the fact there's no recall provision, then the NOMCOM folks are accountable to the entire GNSO or to the NOMCOM committee that appointed them. They're accountable to somebody, but it's not just a question that they can't be recalled because I can't be recalled.
Can I respond to that?
Please do.
If they're only accountable to the nominating committee, again, that's not accountable to the GNSO. I mean, they're GNSO
right.
People delegated to the nominating committee, but they are in no way representing the GNSO. They're not a GNSO group. So, the other point, Ed, is that, you know, the fundamental flaw, you're not accountable because your stakeholder group has chosen not to make you accountable. They've chosen not to instruct you as to the positions you should take. No way to force them to do that. If they choose to waive accountability and say they don't really care if you're accountable or not, or they're only going to care every 2 years, that's their choice. But
Steve, there are many forms of accountability, Steve.
In my constituency, my counselors are accountable because if they defy the instructions of our they're bound to follow the instructions of the constituency that they represent.
All right, this discussion is revealing divided views on why we have NOMCOM voting reps, how they're accountable, if at all, how do we measure their accountability to the GNSO relative to counselors who can't be recalled, and we could actually go quite a while on that question, and yet, if we end up without consensus in this group of doing something other than the default rule, it's a moot point. So I actually went to the voting of NOMCOM reps because I actually sensed we had good support on the last call of not having them vote. It's clear that there's a divided opinion on that. So let's move on to another unresolved question, which is the key one here, and it is looking at test case A, B, C, D, and E. Because if this group can't start to move toward consensus on something other than a majority of each house, then there's no point in wasting time discussing whether the NOMCOM reps can vote. So what I put in these test cases was the understanding that you could achieve a majority or even a two-thirds majority of counselors, and by saying counselors, I'm implying that I'm not counting the NOMCOM reps in this particular version of the table. It's easy to adjust the weight for NOMCOMs back to one instead of zero here. But what you see are just a handful, and there's practically an infinite number, not infinite, but there are a lot of scenarios that would get you to majorities or even two-thirds majorities. I didn't want to use the word supermajority because that's a defined term in each ACNSO. I'd love to invite a discussion about the desirability of moving away from a majority of each house to a majority of counselors after waiting to retain the balance, David Maher and Darcy. I want to make sure that you see that that's what the weight column is there for, to retain the balance so that counselors can vote on a decision like spilling the board without assuming that it has to pass with the majority of each house. Can we have a discussion of that? Steve Metallitz, please.
Yes, thank you. I think this chart is very useful, and as you said, there are a lot of other permutations that you could go through. One way to look at it might be to say, how would the results be different here as compared to the status quo? So if you look at test D, and let's assume, this is a majority vote, but obviously with slight changes you could make it a higher percentage. But so in test D, under this scenario, 58% of the votes are yes, and so if yes only needs a majority, or if they, then yes passes. In the current, under the default rule, as you describe it, the non-contracted party house, a majority here is voting yes. I guess it's 8-4. And the contracted party house is split 6-6. Oh, excuse me, is that right? Yes, 6-6. So that would not result in a majority in both houses. Again, if you take away the non-com votes, the non-com appointee votes here. It's worth just thinking about if you had this setting, and maybe even test E is a better example of it, because there it's 10-2 on one side and still 6-6 on the other side. It's two-thirds if you just count the votes as you've done in this chart, and yet in the status quo or in the default, we would not have a yes vote as a result of this. Now, I recognize that, you know, people's views of this inevitably are determined by whether they picture themselves being in a box with this has a number here or that doesn't have a number. So in test E, I suppose a registrar in this example would be very happy to have this if they were opposed to something. And even though by some measures a rather strong majority and even taking into account, you know, weighted voting supports it. But that just may be, I'm just suggesting this as a way of evaluating this model, and then you could also use that. You could throw back in the NCAs and see what difference that made, or you could look at it even on a house by house basis in some ways. But I'm just suggesting this might be a useful way to think about this: is to look at the results that these tests and other tests that we could devise come up with, and compare them to what the result would be under the default majority of each house rule. Thanks.
Yeah, Steve, thank you for that. This is Steve DelBianco. Test case E is probably one of many kind of glaring examples where a clear majority of GNSO wants a nominee or wants to exercise a decisional participant power but would be blocked under that. And you can always array it so that any one group could block a majority of each house under a lot of different scenarios. So Steve hit the nail on the head. The weighted, balanced majority scheme is designed to avoid problems where the majority can't prevail. Darcy, you're next. Go ahead.
Thanks, Steve. Darcy Stoppel for the record. So I guess when I look at this chart, one of the things I see is this is representative of this SOACs today. What's that going to look like in 2 years? Or even next year, what is to prevent new SOACs from being developed that change these tests quite dramatically? For both sides, I mean, for the non-contracted party house as well as the contracted party house. I mean, I think if you add some SOACs in here, this looks very, very different.
Darcy, could I ask you for clarification, please? It's Steve. This is the SO and AC called the GNSO, so
Right. There
would never be other SOs and ACs. Did you mean constituencies and stakeholder groups?
Oh, I guess maybe. Sorry. You're right. Yes. Yeah, so if you have another stakeholder group that comes in there as a member of either house, that changes this distribution quite a bit.
And Darcy, you're right, and of course, and that would happen regardless of the new bylaws. And that would change things regardless of whether our drafting team ever existed. So you're right, there's a risk that the admission of new stakeholder groups or constituencies in council will potentially affect the voting rules that we have. And having said that, though, we still have a charter to come up with a rule, and I guess we can put an asterisk there. It's just like everything else council votes on, it's subject to change, I guess, if there are new constituencies and stakeholder groups. But I don't want to cut you off there. Did you want to go further on that?
No, I appreciate what you're saying. And, yes, I mean, everything we're doing throughout this whole transition project is open for change over time. But it also makes me hesitant. It's one more reason I'm hesitant to move away from the majority of house rules, because it almost, in a way, prompts the creation of stakeholder groups or constituency groups.
So let me ask you this, Darcy: if the brand registries decided to become a stakeholder group inside of the contract party house, and we never did a transition. Forget the transition, just regular old council actions, you'd have to put them up into that top, and the concern you just raised of what happens to the voting thresholds would be just as valid a concern regardless of whether our drafting team ever existed. So all I'm suggesting is you bring up a good point, but it's not actually a point that's relevant to the work we're doing. It's generally a relevant point. The new constituencies and stakeholder groups, yes, they can happen with or without the transition. Anything to follow up on that, Darcy?
I disagree that it's not relevant. I think that setting up a system that moves away from the House system that we have today and going to a per-stakeholder group voting system almost, or going even at this granular per counselors who should be voting as directed by their stakeholder group, you're almost encouraging the commitment or the creation of new stakeholder groups, potentially packing it on one side or the other. That's all I'm suggesting.
Okay, thank you. And let's go to Ed Morris.
Yeah, hi, thanks, Steve. Provided we bake in the same balance of power, the same relative power, the same relative strengths of power that we have now between the stakeholder groups, I really don't have a problem with tearing down the House structures in the way that you've outlined there. We just need a saving clause somewhere in here stating that should there be a change, an addition of a constituency, for example, in the non-commercial stakeholders group, should there be a third constituency, their representatives per se would have to come out of the NCSG. In other words, we would not add to the overall total. But that's going to happen anyway. If we're going to use council as a basis, whatever decision is made for representation on council would just be transposed into what we're doing here. So I'm not really concerned with what Darcy has brought up, because the implications of a new stakeholder group, for example, would be far more than the empowered community. So I have no real problem with tearing down the houses in the way you've suggested here, as long as we maintain the relative balance of power.
Ed, let's be sure that the record for this call never says that anybody is tearing down the houses. The houses are alive and well and won't be changed at all. We're simply saying that for a vote on things to do with the empowered community, a different voting threshold would be used. The houses are still there. These houses exist for almost all the work that council does. So please don't let the record show that.
For voting purposes, in the new thresholds for the empowered community,
right,
I do not object to a proposal such as that is displayed on the screen right now.
Thank you. And let me ask you one more follow-up before we go to Steve. And that is this, Ed, that I don't have a problem isn't what I would call an endorsement. And it would be better to know whether, for Steve Metallitz's point, he indicates in test case E an outcome where the majority would not prevail under the default voting rule, but under this scheme, the majority, a two-thirds majority of GNSO could prevail. So it would be better to know whether you prefer this method as opposed to you just don't have a problem with it. If you can't say, don't. But I'm just wondering if you go any further than saying I don't have a problem with it.
No. At this point, I don't have a problem with it. If the majority of my fellow members in the DT wanted this, I'm happy to go with it. If folks want to stick with the House structure, I'm fine with that as well. But I certainly won't oppose this. I can see the merits, but I also can see the merits of sticking with our current system because it's known, it's knowable, and it's going to be less confusing as a counselor to know what the heck I'm voting under. And I know that may sound crazy, but staff can tell you, whenever we have a vote, invariably one of us says, what are the rules? And that's
what the
simple structure we have now.
Yeah, good point. Steve Metallitz, please.
Yeah, just 2 points. First, to Ed's last comment, I've offered a proposal that would eliminate that confusion. So I'm happy to go back to that. There would be no confusion among counselors about how to vote on this under my proposal. Second,
could you elaborate on that?
Yes, because if these decisions are not properly made by the GNSO Council. They're made by the constituencies of stakeholders, stakeholder groups that make up the GNSO. So, you know, each constituency would have to decide how it wanted to vote and how it wanted to instruct its leadership, but the counselors would not be faced with this quandary.
And the reason there's no quandary, just to clarify for Ed, is that council wouldn't even be involved,
right,
if the GNSO, if we had a non-council GNSO structure. And this was covered, I think, by Steve on a previous call where I'm not sure that you were on it. So I just wanted to clarify that for Ed. I'm sorry, Steve. Why don't you go ahead?
I really had raised my hand to just say Darcy's right that if there were new stakeholder groups and constituencies, that would, you know, re-scramble things. That's not a new issue. It's ever since we've had this structure, even before we had this structure, that kept coming up. And interestingly, since we've had this structure, there have been no new constituencies and stakeholder groups. And probably, in my view, the reason for that is there's so much of a vested interest in the status quo from those who feel that this is the right way to do things, not just an expedience that was imposed upon us by the board 7 or 8 years ago. But once you have that power, you obviously don't want to give it up. So you don't want it to be diluted. So for that reason, there's an incentive not to encourage new constituencies or stakeholder groups. Again, you could take this away from the vested interests and put it back with the actual participants in the GNSO, and you perhaps avoid that problem. But I think Darcy's point is well taken, that would create a lot of change, but that change, based on past experience, and it could, you know, I don't know how likely that change is to happen. Thank you.
Ed Morris, your hand's up.
Yeah, Steve, I'm a little bit confused. So if anything I said can be applied endorsement of a model that takes the votes away from council, that's not what I intended to say. What I did intend to say was I could live with a voting model, threshold model, if you say, as on the screen for votes within council under the empowered community. So when Steve is telling me, we don't mean council at all, no, that's not what I'm endorsing. What I'm willing to say is that it makes some sense to me, looking at test E, to go to this model. I'd like to hear some arguments the other way, but I certainly want to maintain the votes themselves on council.
Ed, thanks for that question. And what Steve Metallis was suggesting is that if you were trying to solve the problem of confusing voting rules for councilors, you could return to a proposal Steve made two calls ago where councilors don't vote on it. In fact, the stakeholder groups and constituencies simply communicate their decisions to the representative on the empowered community. And so that was a little bit of an aside, because Steve was addressing the confused counselor problem. I think you got it right. What you have on the screen in front of you is our current scenario, the one we're trying to figure out if there's support for, which is keeping it with the council, okay, not with the underlying SGs and constituencies. Keep it with the council, but exploring whether we can come up with a better decision-making method for the purposes of exercising the powers of the empowered community. And so that's where it is relevant what you think about test case E. And I, too, would like to hear a discussion of pros and cons about using a majority or even a supermajority of counselors instead of a majority of each house. And let's take that discussion for 5 more minutes, and then we need to talk about our action plan going forward. All right, not seeing a queue. We have only, okay, go ahead, David.
I think we're overlooking the way the council votes in a variety of different situations. Because I'm looking at the chart of the voting thresholds, and in some cases, what's required is 2/3 of both houses or more than 3/4 of one and 1/2 of another. Another possibility is a much lower threshold. Looking for an example here. 1/3 of both houses could initiate a GNSO guidance process. So that a majority of both houses is not always the case that's required. And I think we should consider that so long as we preserve the principle of the houses voting separately, which to me is a fundamental issue of fairness and an issue that I think would never be abandoned by the council.
David has brought up the GNSO guidance process. That's in the bylaws. It's method number 16. And it was invented, I believe, a few years ago, and we've never used it. It has different thresholds to initiate something. It's called a GGP, and I'll paste it into the chat so you'll see what it is. It certainly should be part of what we discussed, this GGP, because it may be something that's attractive to go towards, but it does preserve the house structure, and it has an initiation and a rejection, and the approvals go straight back to a GNSO supermajority. So the whole value of this GNSO guidance process, which none of us have ever used, is that it seems active in the sense that it's something other than a majority of each house. It's a third of each house. But that's not a decision of council. That's simply to start a process, and then to reject it is a supermajority. So it ends up, the GNSO guidance process doesn't get us very far because it goes straight to a GNSO supermajority to make any decisions, any substantive decisions. It really isn't a substantive decision to simply get one started, to initiate. That's the only place where it differs from supermajority, David. And your hand is still up because you want to weigh in on this?
I've made my point, which is still the issue of the fundamental fairness of preserving a two-house system.
Got it. All right, I don't see any other hands up. We have two more meetings until we have to get our report in. And so it's time to stop brainstorming and, start writing. And so that would mean that I will work with staff for a draft report in the next few days to say, here's what we explored, and here's where we've ended up. Because it's going to take us the next two calls to wordsmith our report to the council, and it's going to be very challenging for that report to reflect broad support for deviating from the default threshold. I hoped to have broader participation. We have 9 members on this drafting team in total. We have 7 on today's call, which is pretty good, 7 of 9. Can't complain about that. But if I asked for a show of hands from members here, how many want to propose something other than a majority of each house for these kinds of decisions? And Steve Metallis, your hand's up.
Yes. It was up before you said put your hand up for that proposition.
That's why I called on you.
Right, thank you. I just want to get back to what David Maher has been saying. I mean, this what's up on the screen here, I think, is one option that we should consider. And, again, as I said, play around with some different scenarios and see how they look and how they would differ from the default rule. The other point, if you look at the status quo, which deals with a lot of things that don't have to do with directly with the empowered community, obviously, but what's in the bylaws now, you have two main thresholds. One is majority of each house, and the other is supermajority, which applies to 7 or 8 things in this list, or I haven't counted them, but a lot of things that the GNSO does now, the GNSO Council does now, and is defined as 2/3 of each house or 3/4 of one and a majority of the other. I think that's another that's another alternative to look at. And kind of to lay side by side with this one. And that's what I would hope we could do, and maybe the staff could, give us a few more permutations here or whatever, or we could do it ourselves. But I hear what David is saying, and, maybe we should look at both of those options. In other words, what you have up here, or using the house structure and again, I'm leaving aside the question of the NCAs, and changing what the threshold would be. That's all I was suggesting. And we already have that the PDP does that requires something more than a majority of each house, and I would submit that some of the things that it would do under the empowered community are probably a lot more significant than some of these.
That's right. And I will send the Excel sheet that this screen came from. I will send that Excel sheet to each of you after the call so that if you wish, you can play with it in different ways. But given that we only have two more calls, and you know, when we get to the end of September, I will hope you will look back and say that we didn't take any more than 10 or 12 hours of your life on this exercise. But I hope you'll also say that we were very open-minded about exploring things like not using counsel. We explored moving away from the default threshold. We looked at and considered whether non-com reps. We've raised some fascinating questions that are going to be part of this report. And I'm not going to suggest until we finish two more calls that I even know whether there's consensus support from this drafting team on what our report's going to say. Because even if our report ends up concluding no change, I do need to get consensus support for a report that describes the things we discussed. So I will look to Julie and staff to help do that. And I guess with only two calls left, our next call has got to be one where we review our report for at least some of the call, maybe the first 20 minutes, and then return to the substantive recommendation, the key part of the report that we're going to send over to council. And that's where we have to start figuring out how close we are to a consensus among the 9 drafting team members. So that's just my guess about the way forward, given the time that's available. But I am happy to entertain whatever you folks think is the right path forward. I'm just the chair here to serve you. If you have other ideas, let's hear about them now. So when I speak about the report, including things we considered, we'd have a description of this table, for instance, would be in the report so that our colleagues and council would understand that we looked rather widely before we settled on something as a default. All right, not seeing any other comments. I think we have a significant amount of writing to do. My guess is this will be a 4 or a 5 page report. I'll work with Julie on the first draft, and my goal would be to get it to you prior to next Wednesday morning's call, Wednesday morning in the U.S., so that there'd be a chance. Oh, gosh. Is it next Wednesday morning that we're meeting? Yeah, it is, isn't it? Let me check something. Yes, next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Eastern time would be our next call. So I would want to try to get, thank you, Julie, I would want to try to get a draft to you at least 24 hours before that. And if it's only going to be 4 or 5 pages, that'll be easy for you to get through them, flag things that are inaccurate, and then reserve at least 2/3 of our call. No, Farzi, to your point, the tests on the table, they're completely made up scenarios indicating to show that majorities and even supermajorities can be achieved without requiring a majority of each house. That is all it is. So maybe that's the only explanation you think that we need, is to explain that you're just using math. How can you show that majorities and supermajorities of GNSO counselors would find out that their decisions were blocked or frustrated under a majority of each house rule? And that's what I'll put in there. So if there's no other comments on this, I think that somebody asked about changing to Thursday. That was you, Matthew. Why don't you speak up on that and propose that? And we'd have to check with everyone, not just the folks on this call. Matthew? I don't want the call to end without discussing the schedule, because the schedule is 9 a.m. East Coast time next Wednesday. To change that, is an inconvenience, and I apologize again for having to force the change today. The Workstream 2 group that I are part of also has a call on Thursday, so I'm conscious of other conflicts that could be provoked. But go ahead, Matthew.
No, that's fine, Steve. I understand. I should be able to join next Wednesday. The following Wednesday, probably not. But that's fine. Not to worry.
Well, thank you, Matthew. If you know that in advance, maybe our final call is one that we could do a doodle poll on. All right, I'm looking at the queue and the chat. I don't see anything else, so I guess the next step is to try to draft a report on where we are so that we can try to get that done. I want to thank everybody, especially staff, for supporting us so far. I'm going to send – I don't know that I can reach the list, Julie. Is the DT list available for me to email directly, or can only staff do that?
Yes, this is Julie. You can – everybody on the list can email to the list.
I have had mine rejected twice, so we'll find out. I'm going to send the Excel sheet to everyone right after this call.
Okay. Thanks. And if for some reason it looks like it didn't get through the list, I'll work with the secretary to find out what's going on.
Wonderful. Hey, thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Steve.
Bye now.
Thanks, all. Have a good
thanks,
morning.
Everyone. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you again. The meeting has been adjourned. Operator, please stop the recordings and disconnect all remaining lines. Enjoy the remainder of your day.